What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Look at my sh**.
Oh, boy, here we go.
I got shorts, every color. Mm-hmm. I got designer t-shirts. I got gold bullets.
Your top five films of the year so far better be as inspired as James Franco's monologue from Spring Breakers. That's all I got to say.
I got Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy in Grease,
okay.
Y'all.
I need you to stop talking like that when we actually start the show.
Why are you suspicious?
This week we'll reveal our favorite films of the year so far, plus Massacre Theater and more.
Spring Break forever.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 1 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM7.
And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. Josh, Squarespace has been a sponsor for a long time now. We like during these Squarespace promotions to mention some testimonials, promote some of our listeners' websites. We know we have a lot of listeners out there who use Squarespace. We would love to get a new batch of those testimonials. So please send your review, your comments about your website and your use of Squarespace to feedback@filmspotting.net. Squarespace is constantly evolving. They keep rolling out new product features, integrations, and templates. And if you have any issues whatsoever, they've got 24/7 support, providing live chats during the week and extremely fast email support throughout the day and night. And it's affordable. They have plans starting as low as $8 a month for software and hosting. Everything is fast and easy to use. It's all drag and drop. And they also now offer Squarespace Commerce, which is a powerful and flexible e-commerce solution. So it works with all their templates. If you want to start selling physical goods or digital goods, whether it's music CDs or MP3s or hardcover books or ebooks, you can do that all through your Squarespace website. And they also offer a great mobile experience. So their templates are responsive to whatever smartphone you're on, tablet or computer. And they also connect to all of your social media accounts. They integrate all your website needs into one platform: domains, design, development, commerce, hosting, and that 24/7 customer support.
For a free trial, go to squarespace.com where you can sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out, and you can start building your own website. If you do decide to purchase it, use offer code FILM7, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That includes monthly and annual plans. Don't forget about free domain registrations for annual plan customer subscriptions as well. That's squarespace.com, and use offer code FILM7. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Josh was so unnerved by my uncanny impression of James Franco's Alien from Spring Breakers that I've gone ahead and let out my braids for our countdown of the best films of the year so far.
Don't expect me to weave those things back up for you, Adam.
Oh, come on. We got all night. We're also going to share our worst films of the year so far, but we're not going to start with the bad. We're going to start with the good. Let's kick off the countdown.
Do you know this place?
I want to say yes for you. I want to.
Is there a direction that you feel that you are drawn to?
Is there one you feel drawn to?
I say right.
Left.
You sure?
No. Then let's go right. I'm going to go wherever you go. You know that.
I feel like you know.
So a little bit of misdirection here off the top, Josh, as that's a scene featuring Shane Carruth and Amy Simetz from Shane Carruth's Upstream Color, a movie that listeners have been clamoring for us to talk about for some time. And I had just kept putting off and putting off, even though I knew it was only 90 minutes long, and I knew that I was excited about it. One of my most anticipated films of the year. I was a fan of Primer. I really wanted to see what he was going to do with his follow-up film. I knew it was going to be a lot of heavy lifting. I knew it was going to be an experience, and I just couldn't get in the right mindset for it. I finally, in preparation for this list, watched it just a couple nights ago, and it is not going to make my top five, though in a roundabout way, it's going to help explain my top five, which I didn't really anticipate. But having just seen it, I thought maybe we could use this opportunity to spend a minute or two
sure.
on the film. It is a movie you wrote about on your site back around the time it came out. And I told our producer, Sam Van Halgren, about a month or so ago when I saw some of the reviews coming out, saw some of the tweets and comments on Letterboxd. I said to him that I wasn't going to write or say anything about the movie if all I had to say about it was some variation on all the same comments I was seeing everywhere, because they're virtually the same comments that come up with any challenging, mind-bending film like this. And I can say this because I've been guilty of it myself over the years. It's some combination of, I'm still processing it, but I can't wait to watch it again. It's mesmerizing. It's haunting. I haven't been able to shake some of the images. And number three, it doesn't necessarily make narrative sense, but it makes emotional sense. I didn't want to say that, Josh. And now that I've seen it, guess what? That's pretty much exactly where I'm at with Upstream Color. All three of those things.
You don't have the perfect explanation for what it all means?
I don't.
We've all been waiting these months.
I know. All this time, all this buildup, and I've got nothing more to add. Not entirely true, but it was a film I was confounded by, I was confused by at times, I was frustrated by it at times as well. But I can honestly admit that I was glued to the screen, and by the end of it, I was putting together pieces, at least so far as seeing the patterns I think Shane Carruth had put in place as a director. I could anticipate lines of dialogue. I could anticipate images because I was starting to see how the patterns connected. I couldn't necessarily tell you what they all meant, but I could at least see the patterns. And that was enough to carry me through the entire film and to make me want to see it again and not necessarily look for meaning in everything, but just see how those patterns fit together and try to draw more from it.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate the devotion that Carruth has among, I mean, he's got some really ardent fans, and they'll claim that Primer and this film are among the best that have been made in the last 10 years or so. I can't quite go that far with it, but I'm in a similar position that you are in that I do appreciate what's going on here. It's sort of this balance where the movie's clearly working on its own idiosyncratic wavelength,
mm-hmm.
but it's not alienating. Sometimes films like this will just alienate
right.
me, and I'm out. As you said, you wanted to see what happened. You kept tied to the narrative. I wouldn't at the same time say that it's quite approachable for me either in the way that I'm prompted to do that heavy lifting that the movie probably deserves. It's probably more on me than the film.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes these movies, I think of Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain.
Right.
For whatever reason, the oddness and the strangeness and all of the things going on there that structurally are somewhat similar to a movie like Upstream Color, that grabbed me, and I just wanted to dive in and mm-hmm. try to figure out, what does this say to me? How are these connections important? Upstream Color, I could see them there and I appreciated them, but for whatever reason, didn't really move me to jump fully in.
Okay.
Does that make any sense?
It does make sense, though I did respond more strongly than you. I was finding myself really eager to dive in again and see some of those patterns. And The Fountain is a good parallel. It's another movie I liked. I went along for the ride with that film, and I put this movie at least on par with The Fountain, if not even better, actually. And like I said, it didn't quite make my top five. It is one of my honorable mentions. It's a movie that I thought showed enough artistry and did have me wrapped enough that, like I said, can't wait to see it again. It stands out for me in this year of cinema as one of those films when you're watching the work of someone who so clearly knows what he's doing and has a purpose for it. That's real artistry, and it grabs me.
Sure, the vision is undeniably unique.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure.
I think what really stood out to me, I can say the one thing I was able to connect with beyond the visuals, is that it is a movie, like so many, about identity. Specifically, though, identity and how it explores this idea of our lives not necessarily being our own. Our behavior, sometimes what dictates our behavior and how in control of our lives are we really? And more importantly, Josh, what really did land with me is this sense maybe of how we come up with stories, how we process stories and fashion them into narratives that help us understand the world and our role in it. And so it was very odd to me, actually, or very serendipitous that I just watched Upstream Color. And the next night I was listening to an episode of WTF with Marc Maron where he was talking to David Sedaris. And David Sedaris told this great story about how he had been a smoker for a long time, like 30 years, and he wanted to quit. And he really only wanted to quit because he wanted to stay at nicer hotels. And he couldn't stay at the nice hotels because they didn't allow smoking. But what he told himself was, okay, you're going to quit smoking. You've smoked every cigarette you're supposed to smoke. He basically came up with this story that was, you've had every cigarette you need to have. If you have one more, it won't even tastes good to you. It will have no effect on you. You've had all the cigarettes you're supposed to have. That little narrative, that was somehow his way of processing what he was going through. And it worked for him. And I think we're all, I don't know if guilty is the right word, but we do things like that. And you see that come through in this film, in these characters. We haven't talked about the plot at all because you can't really talk about the plot at all. If you haven't seen Upstream Color, just seek it out and see if you are able to go along for the ride or not. But that is something that landed with me, is that notion of narratives and how we use them. It's something I've talked about a lot over the years here on the show. And I do think that as I talk about the artistry on display, I think Kruth is exploring that and using the language of cinema in a way that few filmmakers do. Antonioni's one who's done it. Malick is certainly one who's done it over the years, which is one where he's basically saying, okay, if this is truly a medium that's not text-based, this isn't a book, this is about sound and images colliding together, I'm going to construct a narrative based on color, based on editing, based on tone, texture, faces, music, and those things coming together. I'm not going to give you psychological explanations for everything that's going on. I'm not going to give you cause and effect chain of events. I'm truly going to make this a visual medium, and I really respect that and respond to it.
It's very much a collage, and it's almost experimental. And I think that's where I get caught up a little bit in the fact that I can't quite give myself entirely over to the experimental nature. There's a film on my list that's purely experimental, that it's on my top five, so I clearly responded to. And something like Upstream Color still has enough of a narrative identity where you feel the responsibility, and maybe this is a responsibility I shouldn't feel, to try to piece it together in a way. And maybe that was my slight resistance to it, is that I didn't just give myself over to the collageness, to the images and the editing and the colors,
right,
as I did in this other film I'll talk about.
Okay, just a few thoughts there on Shane Carruth's Upstream Color. May come up again briefly here as we get through our list of our favorite films of the year so far, though I will mention again, just missed my top five and one. Clearly not really in contention for you, Josh, though you did respond positively to it overall. Let's go ahead and get to our list. What's your number five?
Before I get right to it, I am going to mention that one thing I did with this list, I didn't want to quite repeat some of the things I said earlier, so I'll touch on my general reactions, but I also wanted to look back on some of the reviewers who I do really respect and see what they said about these films as well. I don't really get a chance to do that because, as a rule, I don't read anything until I've written my piece or we've talked about it on the show here, and so this was kind of an opportunity to do that. So I'm going to pluck from some other reviewers and give their responses to these top films. Also gives me a little more support and, you know,
absolutely,
why I have these on my list.
I thought about going down this same path. I'm glad I didn't. So you've got the floor here.
All right. Well, I'll start with Like Someone in Love, Abbas Kiarostami's film we reviewed early in the year. It's set in Tokyo. It's about an encounter between a student who's working as a call girl and her older professor client. When we talked about the film, I spent a lot of time, we both did, talking about the elegant visuals. There's a lot going on with reflections in this movie that's thematically important and also just purely gorgeous. Also really appreciated Rin Takanashi's performance as Akiko, the call girl. Now, one thing that I noted about this film is how it did riff on, even though it had this different setting in Tokyo where he's never been before, some similar and familiar Kiarostami themes, identity again, duality, all of this is at play. Jeffrey Overstreet, though, who blogs at Looking Closer, he wrote about this film as a tragicomic love story, which I didn't really pick up on at all, but this is what he had to say. Like Someone in Love is a movie about love, how much we need it, how we go wrong in the way we pursue it, and how one world's ideas about it are passing while another's are taking over. The old world's ideas were filled with romance, rituals, beauty, and intimacy, but they were also hierarchical and cruel in unusual ways, and women were disrespected, mistreated, even abused. The new world's ideas? The world is a marketplace, and love, like anything else you might want, can be bought. So again, that's a thread, didn't jump out to me, but I do think is definitely there in that film. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this one, like a couple others on my list, kind of in that middle ground right now, not in theaters, not available for streaming, and don't have a DVD release date that I could find yet. So hopefully that will be made available somewhere pretty soon.
Yeah, and when we do find out about that, I'm sure we'll bring it up here on the show because it's another film I had a very strong response to. An honorable mention for me, again, just missed my top five, but a very, very good film, Like Someone in Love. As I set up my top five a little bit, I mentioned that in a roundabout way, Upstream Color helped me understand my list. And my list has actually been set. I'll say this, my top five hasn't really changed in about a month or so. I've been keeping track on Letterboxd. I have a private list, and I'm sure you do too. I've been ranking my films, and this top five has been set, and I wasn't thinking about my top five in terms of any patterns or any themes or anything like that. Just This is how I rank the films. And then after thinking about Upstream Color and all that stuff about narrative and stories and processing the stories in our own lives, it occurred to me that this joke we have, Josh, about how I tend to go gaga for movies that are meta and they're movies about movies, even if they're not explicitly so, sometimes they're just movies about the creative process. Well, those are films that I do have a strong personal reaction to. And I noticed looking at my top five that that thread does run through, you could argue, all five of my films. They're, if not about movie making, some of them are very aware of their standing within a larger cinematic context, or they're just about that notion of storytelling in general. So maybe it's not a shock that I would have that response as I love movies, but it's not as simple as loving movies about movies. I am drawn to movies that seem to be about the creative process and creative people, but also that idea of using narratives in our daily lives, the way Upstream Color explores that. And so that leads right into my number five, though one of the more explicitly cinematic-based films in my top five. It is a movie we didn't get a chance to review on the show, Après Mai, or its American title is Something in the Air, from writer-director Olivier Assayas. It did open in select cities, including Chicago, just this past May, I believe, but I saw it last October at the Chicago International Film Festival, and it's a film that really has stuck with me. Assayas now has made three really great films in a row. I think you could argue three masterpieces, potentially, with Summer Hours, and then Carlos, and now this. And listeners out there who are even more familiar with Assayas' work than I am will see parallels in Après Mai to Cold Water. It's a movie, unfortunately, I can't get my hands on, but it's another similarly autobiographical film. It has an alter ego character named Gilles, just like this movie does, standing in for Assayas himself. The title comes from the notion of after May 1968, the student protests in France, and you've got a high school student in Gilles getting swept up in this revolutionary fervor. And the question, the artistic question that Assayas poses, I think, in this film is a really fascinating one, which is, can the artist truly be political? Or must a real artist be selfish and be self-centered and focused only on their work? And you get some lines that explicitly deal with that notion where someone tells him, you're an artist, you're solitary. And so that's what he really seems to be wrestling with. And if that's not the challenge for all artists and revolutionaries, it's at least the challenge, I think, for Assayas as an artist. And I like how he plays with that. Here you see this character who's ablaze, quite literally at times, fire is a dominant motif in the film, with this fervor and this passion for film, but not so much having a political cause. And he's trying to reconcile the two, and sometimes that's a really difficult process. There are open discussions here, Josh, about the role of the filmmaker and what type of aesthetic should be employed to achieve the best results if you're trying to incite revolution or incite change. So, of course, I'm going to geek out on some of that stuff a little bit. But my favorite single moment in the entire film is the scene where his older girlfriend, early in the movie, this isn't a spoiler, is breaking up with him. And up to this point, the camera hasn't been overly grandiose at all. And they're talking about how he's too caught up in cinema. That comes up a little bit in the beginning of the film. And she says, don't watch me walk away, which is such a melodramatic Hollywood kind of line. And what does Assayas do? He then cuts to a crane shot of her walking away and the camera drifting up into the air, making it really grandiose and making it almost like this Michael Curtiz Casablanca type shot. It's that placement within a cinematic context that I thought was really fun to watch Assayas explore. But again, those larger questions about the role of the artist are always questions that appeal to me. And this is a film clearly that really was effective for me.
Yeah, I'm deficient in my Assayas viewership. I know you've been pushing me to see this one and haven't caught up with it yet. The only one of his I've seen is Demon Lover and wasn't too wild about that.
No, and
probably
not
the best place to start.
It's not, probably. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of Demon Lover either. I will say, if people are thinking about seeking out this film, a great double bill would be Après Mai and Goodbye First Love. This is a movie from last year. They're both coming-of-age tales, though this one's focused on a young girl. They both star Lola Cretan, who is very fine young French actress. And this one's directed by Mia Hansen-Love, who happens to be Assayas's wife.
Uh-huh.
It's available via Netflix Instant. And if you've seen Après Mai and then watch this, as I did in that order, they feel like they're of a pair. They feel like they belong together. Unfortunately, like your number five pick, like Someone in Love, there's no release date yet for this film. So you're just going to have to wait and see when it comes out on DVD. But that's my number five, Après Mai.
My sweet love. My hope.
You're everything to me. Speak with me.
All right, for number four, I have To the Wonder, Terrence Malick's latest, and it feels to me like his most personal film, the most personal one he's done. It's about this fading relationship between Ben Affleck's American and Olga Kurylenko's European. And the way I saw it is that their relationship works as this metaphor for our pursuit of relationship with God and the insurmountable distance we often feel. Javier Bardem has a side role as a priest that kind of really brings that part into the picture. This happened to be Roger Ebert's final review, actually, before he died in April. And he responded in particular to the charge of confusion that was thrown at this film. It wasn't as critically adored as some of Malick's other pictures have been. And that's one thing people kept picking up on, that he'd gone over the edge this time, finally, in terms of narrative confusion. But here's what Ebert had to say about that. Why must a film explain everything? Why must every motivation be spelled out? Aren't many films fundamentally the same film with only the specifics changed? Aren't many of them telling the same story? Seeking perfection, we see what our dreams and hopes might look like. We realize they come as a gift through no power of our own. And if we lose them, isn't that almost worse than never having had them in the first place? So a little bit different reading than mine, but he did seem to see and sense here that this was a movie of sorrow, which I definitely picked up on. Still really, really like To the Wonder.
Yeah, that's one. Obviously, I had super high expectations for being Terrence Malick and loving The Tree of Life as much as I did, as you did. And I guess my only response to Mr. Ebert would be that not all unclear movies are created equal. And we've certainly seen that with other Malick films.
And Upstream Color.
And
it's
Upstream
related
Color.
To that.
And
yeah.
That's where I was going. For me, that was the first film, To the Wonder, of Malick's that I can recall really feeling adrift.
You were
really
on the feeling, outside of that one.
Yeah, and really feeling as if, though obviously I have no sense of this and am not trying to judge him this way, feeling like he was adrift, feeling like he was really searching for what he was trying to say rather than having that purpose to it, that I saw Shane Carruth that I felt like came through loud and clear in Upstream Color. So To the Wonder was unfortunately a disappointment for me, but I know you had a strong reaction to it.
This one is going to be available for DVD purchase on August 6th, so not too far away here.
Well, a movie at number four for me that you didn't have as positive a reaction to, though you did ultimately come down favorably on it. It's a movie I obviously loved. It is Mud from writer-director Jeff Nichols, I should say. This is one, if you look at it within this context I set up of drawing attention to itself as a movie or calling on cinema history, this one doesn't at all unless you want to view Jeff Nichols' work in this film in particular through a Spielbergian lens, as I know some critics have wanted to do. But undoubtedly, and I think we talked about this a little bit during our review, it is a kind of modern fairy tale where you've got two boys discovering a boat in a tree and the man who lives there, played by Matthew McConaughey, who calls himself Mud, who tells them this crazy story about how he's trying to reunite with his true love, Juniper, played by Reese Witherspoon, almost like she's a princess character, and they're trying to avoid the evil men who are out there to try and get them. They're mythical characters, and they take on mythical status for the main character, this young boy, Ellis. He seems, what, about eighth grade, maybe about 14 years old, I think he is. He latches on to this narrative that Matthew McConaughey's character has given to him to try to make sense of the things he's dealing with in his life. Questions about love, about masculinity, about marriage. He's dealing with his parents potentially splitting up. Certainly there's some trouble in the marriage. And he's having trouble with identity in terms of having to come to terms with the fact that his current way of life, they live on the Mississippi River, and he identifies himself as a person who lives on the river, and that's different than the kind of person who lives in town. He's struggling with that because maybe he's going to have to go become one of those people. So this relationship and this story that Matthew McConaughey gives him is something he really latches onto, and I did as well. It's like a great Flannery O'Connor story, same milieu, that southern setting, but there's a real richness and novelistic quality to the film. Great ensemble, McConaughey doing great work as he has been for the past couple of years. The boys in the film, Ellis and his friend Neckbone.
Oh, they're fantastic.
So good. Ty Sheridan and Jacob Laughlin. I know we split a little bit on Reese Witherspoon. I think she does exactly what the part needs her to do. Not a great role for her necessarily, not a lot of heavy lifting to do, but she does what she has to. And then you've got those other supporting characters like Sam Shepard, Ray McKinnon, who pops up in Jeff Nichols' work. Michael Shannon appears in a role as well, and he's always very good. If somehow you've been listening to Film Spotting for the past 2 or 3 years and haven't caught up with the work of Jeff Nichols, Shotgun Stories, Take Shelter, and now Mud, you've got some great work ahead of you.
Yeah, I wonder if I did underappreciate this possibly. This might be one of those high expectations coming back to bite me a little bit. I definitely want to take another look at Mud, even though I did generally like it.
It's out on DVD August 6th.
A hastily thrown together massacre theater is next. I was really afraid we were going to have to do some improv until Candace, our associate producer, came up with this scene.
Here's the situation, Josh. Two film critics trapped in a radio studio.
Yikes. We should all thank Candace for saving us from that. Stay with us. Say you want me. Say it loud. Hey folks, just want to jump in here a minute to remind you that we're pleased to be presented again by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM7.
We're also proud to be brought to you once again by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect image or video for your next creative project, whether that's a website, publication, an advertisement, video, or any type of project. You can choose from over 1 million high-quality stock video clips, and they have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most of them come in HD. They source their clips from filmmakers, and they add over 10,000 new clips each week to their site. So every time you visit, you'll find something new. They offer flexible pricing. You can choose between individual clips or video packs. And as we said, you can download those in HD or just use standard definition or web formats. And as Film Spotting is a global show, Shutterstock is a complete global offering. They have offices in more than a dozen countries, and they offer multilingual customer service with dedicated corporate reps and full-time support throughout the week.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just start an account. Begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. And be sure to save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM7, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM7. Say you want me. Say it's fine. Take the light in.
Hey, what are you doing, man? Hey, what are you doing? Come
Don't
on, quit messing around, Drake. Come on. Bishop? Hey, man.
Do it, Bishop.
Hey, not me, man.
Yeah, you.
Hey, come on, quit messing around.
Don't move.
Come on.
Trust me.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Lance Henriksen, very memorably as Bishop in James Cameron's Aliens. We're going to ask you a little bit later in the segment for your favorite actor playing a robot. That's our subject as we look ahead to Pacific Rim, the new film from Guillermo del Toro. Should be a fun poll question. We'll get to that in a minute. Right now, though, it's time for, I think it's everybody's favorite part of the show. I know it's Josh's Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, guest host Michael Phillips and I massacred this movie.
My colleagues believe that I'm wasting my time with you, but I believe you wish to do the right thing. We're willing to wipe the slate clean, give you a fresh start. And all that we're asking in return is your cooperation in bringing a known terrorist to justice.
Yeah. Wow, that sounds like a really good deal. But I think I got a better one. How about I give you the finger? And you give me my phone call.
Oh, Mr. Anderson. You disappoint me.
You can't scare me with this Gestapo crap. I know my rights. I want my phone call.
And tell me, Mr. Anderson, what good is a phone call if you're unable to speak?
That was Hugo Weaving as Agent Smith and Keanu Reeves as Mr. Anderson, or Neo, in 1999's The Matrix, written and directed by Andy and Lana Wachowski.
That is right. Lana, though, formerly Larry at
Correct.
The time The Matrix was made, of course. And I loved listening to that scene that you guys performed because you were so right, Josh. I had never thought about the uncanny similarity between Michael Phillips' voice and Hugo Weaving.
I always
but
knew he sounded
on.
Like somebody.
It's
and it wasn't
on.
Until this scene was suggested where I was like, that's the guy.
And then somehow you did channel at least Bill and Ted's era,
yeah.
Keanu Reeves.
Right actor, wrong movie, huh?
I think, though, that may have been the best Massacre Theater ever, if best means most verisimilitude. It
most
was the
accurate.
Closest to the real thing.
Okay, good.
Yeah, you guys really did nail it. We got this from Alex Scott Moffat in Montreal. I knew that it was The Matrix the instant Michael Phillips began his impressive Agent Smith impression. I barely need to explain how the allegorically filled Matrix trilogy relates to your top five from that week. Neo, the Chosen One, is the ultimate modern Christ figure, and Josh really imbued that holiness into Keanu Reeves' impression. Whoa.
That wasn't too bad either. Eric Bergen from Cameron Park, California, which is near Sacramento, said, Michael Phillips is a dead ringer for Mr. Smith. Josh, thankfully, is no Neo. This week, I guess it was Adam who couldn't speak.
Well done. Drawing on that scene. Aaron Teachman in Washington, D.C. closes us out with a couple more connections. The chart-topping tie-in is that Keanu Reeves' Neo is the one whose coming was foretold and who, spoilers, sacrifices himself to save mankind, making him a rather Christ-like figure. On the B-side, The Matrix, as you may remember, ends with Neo stepping out of a phone booth and flying away, rather like a certain Caped Crusader, a role Reeves was linked to for a hot second or two back in the day. And a deep cut just for real fans, Aaron writes, Keanu played Klaatu in the less accomplished version of The Day the Earth Stood Still, not the one Mr. Larson and Phillips discussed on the show.
Less accomplished, that's a very kind way of putting it.
It is, and there was one more that several listeners caught. Lawrence Fishburne stars in both The Matrix as Morpheus. He's also in Man of Steel, which is the movie you guys reviewed on that show. If you want to hear that scene, hear Michael Phillips' eerie Hugo Weaving impression and the review of Man of Steel, plus their top five movie Christ figures. You can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. A lot of entries, but not as anticipated, Josh, by many listeners, the most entered ever. I was shocked.
Huh?
Maybe it wasn't as close to the real thing as we thought, but there were a ton of entries. You have a very full Film Spotting hat. Reach in and pick out this week's winner.
That would be Rob Hack from Honolulu, Hawaii.
Rob has been a long, long, long time listener and has entered Massacre Theater many a time. I'm glad to see
this
him
was the
finally
time,
win.
Huh?
Congratulations, Rob. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Dracula requires presence. It's all in the eyes and the voice and the head.
That's right. That's right. You seem a little agitated. You want to go outside and get some air?
I'm ready now. Roll the camera.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free. We picked this scene really because it's a great scene from a great movie. So it ties in a way, with our best films of the year so far, though we will note it is not a 2013 movie. It's a recent movie, though. There's a hint for you. It is a recent film.
I think you just confused a lot of people.
I probably did. There's probably one or two other tie-ins very astute listeners may pick up on. We'll have to see how it goes. I'm sure there are two or three others that we never considered at all. And I think that's all we need to say about it. You're going to give me the juicy part here because yeah. I've been off.
Are you a little rusty or you think this will be okay?
I don't know.
Let's
I don't
find
know.
Out.
We just have to go for it here. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
I can't offer you a legally binding union. It won't hold up in the state, the county, or frankly any courtroom in the world due to your age, lack of a license, failure to get parental consent. But the ritual does carry a very important moral weight within yourselves. You can't enter into this lightly. Look into my eyes. Do you love each other?
Yes, we do.
Think about what I'm saying. Are you sure you're ready for this?
Yes, we are.
You're not listening to me. Let me rephrase it.
We're in a hurry.
Are you chewing gum? Spit out the gum, sister. In fact, everybody, I don't like the snappy attitude. This is the most important decision you've made in your lives. Go over by that trampoline and talk it through before you give me another quick answer.
And scene. Not rusty at all.
No, I think I did okay
nice.
There. I have a lot in common maybe with that actor. I'd like to think anyway. If you know what movie we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, July 19th, though you actually have some wiggle room there if you don't quite get it in by the 19th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Babe, you remember that hedge fund manager I met inside? Marshall Hellman?
The Stanford guy?
Yeah, super smart. He was in for some tax thing, but he'll be out soon. He's got money in Dubai and a lot of connections. I can get us back to where we were, and I promise, I can make that happen.
Okay, baby.
We get to our poll question results here. With that scene from Steven Soderbergh's Side Effects, Channing Tatum and Rooney Mara as husband and wife, Martin Taylor and Emily Taylor. And Side Effects was one of the options here, as on our last show together, Josh, we were looking ahead to this show, our top five films of the year so far, and we were looking for movies that we split on to try to gauge who got it most wrong this year. These are the options we came up with. Josh's negative review of Side Effects,
which I said was increasingly strained and eventually alienating.
My negative review of Oz the Great and Powerful.
A semi-debacle, you called it, that thoroughly lacks a cohesive, convincing narrative.
Your review, Josh, of Spring Breakers.
That would be the work of a provocateur without much purpose.
Or finally, my negative review of The Great Gatsby.
Which really made you want to dust off your copy of the book.
Yeah, not in such a good way. It made me just want to go back to that text and focus on that. So those were your four options. How did it come out, Josh?
Well, can I just say that I was under no illusion that I had any chance in this poll, and that's the way it went. Only 8% voted for your negative review of Oz, only 13% for your negative review of The Great Gatsby. So the only real suspense here was which of my reviews was going to come out on the bad end. My negative review of Spring Breakers, 30%, which means my negative review of Side Effects won the poll, I guess is how you say it.
Sure.
50% of the vote.
How about that? We got some great comments here, though it's funny because our first one from a user who identifies themselves as D Germ did the work for me, Josh, because I had this joke all prepared where I was going to say this really was an unfair poll question from the get-go, because the two films that you were negative about are actually good films.
I don't think that's really what he says here.
The reality, though, is that it really was unfair because of the fact that if you look at my two films, Side Effects and Spring Breakers, genuinely liked films. The two films that were chosen for me in this poll, The Great Gatsby and Oz, not a whole lot of love out there. So it did seem like it was stacked against you from the beginning. And I was going to go to Rotten Tomatoes and pull the evidence for this, but D-Germ did the work for me. He says, come on, really? The deck is stacked against Josh. Did Adam write this question? The two Josh choices are much more outside the general consensus. Rotten Tomatoes is not the end-all be-all, but in this case, they help make my point. Two Rottens for Adam's negative reviews, Gatsby 49%, Oz 59%. Two Freshes for Josh's negative reviews, Spring Breakers 65 and Side Effects 84. How about Adam's mostly negative review of Stoker, 68% fresh, or even To the Wonder? Rotten Tomatoes is not my friend on this point, 42% fresh, but I think the film spotting community would at least have to think about it a little more. Both of those seem potentially much more controversial than his Gatsby and Oz opinions, which are pretty widely accepted slash agreed upon. It was nice of your wife. I didn't realize that you used D-Germ. That's for Debbie. The D is for your wife, Debbie. She wrote in to defend you,
hey,
Josh.
Don't criticize my dirty talk, Adam.
We did, for the record, talk about that. You recall we threw out the idea of maybe Stoker should be in there.
Yeah.
Both of those films, though, are just so little seen that it didn't seem like they would garner much favor here in the poll question. So that's the story we're sticking to anyway. Or we just stacked the deck against Josh, which is always fun as well.
All right. Ryan F. wrote in and said, of the options given, I actually agree to a degree with three of the four statements. And the fourth regarding Side Effects, I think, is a reasonable reaction to the film. I personally love the movie, but it'd be kind of unreasonable for me to demand that Josh have an overall positive reaction when he didn't have an overall positive experience. I think the alienation was intentional and works with the overall theme of the film, but naturally your mileage may vary. So some sort of support there.
Yeah. We do have this from Charles Canzoneri, proof that we are the perfect pairing, apparently, of sweet and salty. Where's the option for I agree with all of these?
Well, now things start to get ugly.
Yes,
Edwin
they do.
Arnauden. Question, looking back at the year so far, who got it the most right? Answer, Josh's negative review of Spring Breakers.
Okay, some support there, but it goes on. Aaron Fenn, Josh was so wrong on his review of Spring Breakers that I had to put that episode on repeat.
Oh, man.
Film spotting on repeat,
here
y'all.
Here we go. Martin Cuevas said, where's the option to say Josh got it the most wrong and is completely crackerballs? Crackerballs, that's a new one. When he said Rocky 6 was better than the original.
I love that they're just drawing on past mistakes here.
Well, to use. Wait a minute. Yeah. Past mistakes?
Exactly.
I don't think so.
The hits keep on coming. Ben H., where's the option to say Josh got it the most wrong when he said all the original Star Trek films were worthless?
All right. All right. Ben, do your research. Star Trek 5, Final Frontier.
Oh, brother.
I like that movie.
Oh, no. You're not helping your cause any. We close with this comment. More fun with Josh. Larson's legacy of being wrong about the Star Trek franchise is truly epic. This, again, from Ryan F. He's changed his
tune
now.
Wait a minute.
First Contact, better than Wrath of Khan. Into Darkness, anything more than a lukewarm pastiche of the very movies Larson didn't enjoy. Embarrassing,
he says. Come on, Ryan, pick a side.
Well, our listeners picked a side, and they say I was more right than you this year. We'll see how the responses are overall to our top five. That brings us to this week's poll question, our top five movie robots, which until Sam suggested this, I'm being totally honest here, I had no idea that this is really what Pacific Rim was about.
Come on.
No, I didn't. It's like robots versus sea creatures or something. What is going on in this movie?
You knew
no,
it was
I didn't.
About. What did you
Honestly,
think it was about?
I have no idea what it's about.
You didn't even see a poster of a giant robot?
I haven't. And I love it. I love that I am literally going in totally clueless, because that's how I prefer to go in.
All right. Well,
I have no idea. I don't know how you.
I don't know how you manage that, but
there are robots.
It's quite a feat.
I try to.
Now, see, I didn't know they were sea monsters. I just thought they were monsters. So now you spoil that for me.
I may be wrong there about the sea monsters. We'll have to see. But there are robots. So that got us thinking about our favorite robots. We're going to share our top five on our next new show. And we're giving you five options here for the best actor portraying a robot. Those choices are
Rutger Hauer as Roy Batty in Blade Runner, Lance Henriksen as Bishop in Aliens, Robert Patrick's T-1000 in Terminator 2, Jude Law as Gigolo Joe in AI Artificial Intelligence, and lastly, a more recent film, Michael Fassbender as David in Prometheus.
How do we even throw Fassbender in here? I mean, he should win every poll question ever.
This is some tough competition, I think.
It is tough.
And I did like Fassbender and Prometheus. About the only thing I liked. But yeah, these are some good performances.
Yeah, we're going to hold off and let you make your choices without knowing where we fall, because I'm sure that would influence you. But as it turns out, I just really have no idea what my answer is. And I need another week or so to think about it. You've got a little bit of time as well. But you can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net is where you'll find information about a couple contests we have going on. I love giving away movie passes. In fact, they're not even really contests. We're just giving away passes. And if you're one of the first to go to the website and click on the right link, you may be one of the lucky winners. We've got two films that sound pretty interesting to me, Josh. The first one, The Hunt. This is the new film from Thomas Vinterberg, the guy that did the great Danish film, The Celebration. He co-wrote this movie and directed it. Mads Mikkelsen stars. And on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. here at the Landmark in Chicago. So this is obviously for our Chicago listeners or people who are at least nearby to make the trek in. You can have a chance at winning a couple of free passes to see that advanced screening of the film. The link again to enter that contest is available at filmspotting.net. The other film that we have passes to give away for is Drinking Buddies. This is the new film from Chicago's own Joe Swanberg. It stars Olivia Wilde. Anna Kendrick is in the movie. And Josh, if those two names don't sell you, my boy Jake Johnson.
Yep. Getting excited for this.
I know you're excited.
I just saw the trailer for this today.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Not only Jake Johnson, robots and sea monsters.
Well, you know, I can see that. They sell.
Yep.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say this movie is actually about people who drink. Friends who drink.
Yeah, it looked a little more like that.
Maybe so. But I do love Jake Johnson. And I'm excited to see Drinking Buddies just based on that cast. That screening is Thursday, July 25th at 7 p.m., also at the Landmark. It will be followed by a Q&A with the director, Joe Swanberg. So again, if you want to enter for free passes to either Drinking Buddies or The Hunt, you can do that now on our main page, filmspotting.net. Also want to throw out a plug for our bonus content, which you can get if you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone or Android. All the information you need about our apps and how to get that bonus audio is available as well at our site, filmspotting.net, and just click on the app's link. And I think this week's bonus content is pretty interesting stuff. I know we have a lot of listeners out there, Josh, who like to fill up their queues or add movies to their Amazon list or however they get movies based on some of the films that come up here on the show. And as you recall, about a month or so ago, we played my interview with Robert K. Elder about his new book, The Best Movie You've Never Seen. So 35 directors talking about their favorite film that is kind of overlooked or in their minds unfairly maligned. And we got some really good responses to that interview with listener picks for their best movie you've never seen. We'll share those in the bonus content. And I think that brings us to a point here in the show, Josh, where I just wanted to take a moment to thank some people for the fact that I've been off, as a few people have noticed here. I don't know that I've been missed all that much, Josh, but I have taken a little bit of time here this summer. It's something we had planned a couple months ago.
Yeah, right.
We talked about it in the summer. I would definitely not say I was getting burned out. That doesn't apply because I always have fun recording the show. But I was at a point where I was recognizing that I had never really gone more than about 10 days between episodes of Film Spotting in over 8 years.
Which is crazy.
Which is kind of crazy. And I said, you know what? This summer, let's at least lighten the load a little bit. Maybe 4 or 5 weeks where we alternate weeks, spend a little bit more time at home. I also knew that there was potential for my schedule in general to just fill up and things were going to get a little bit nuts, and that happened. So it turns out we did schedule this time off to give myself a little bit of a breather, but you did great work with Michael here on the show a few weeks ago, so my thanks to him. My thanks to you for picking up the slack. Obviously, Joe has done a lot more work on the show, and the MVP, really, Sam Van Halgren, filling in with those revisited episodes and the great writing he's done, and having to do some recording, too. It's great to get him back on the microphone. Actually, that's all it was just a ruse to get him back
secret
on the
plan.
Mic. So I do want to thank Sam and everyone else for that. And we will get back to our normal broadcasting schedule here soon.
Yeah, we'll probably go a little lighter load for the rest of the summer, it sounds like. And then maybe by late summer, pick
August.
Up full steam again.
Yeah, that probably is the plan. Certainly by mid-August, I think we'll be back into our normal format. I joked that maybe I haven't been missed all that much. It's funny because there was one Facebook comment from a listener who said, you know, no offense, but the episode with Josh and Michael was the best episode in a long time.
Well, so there I hope was that. You didn't take any offense at that.
No, of course not. So there was that. But then, Anders, there were two tweets saying they missed me. So two beats the one, and clearly, people are happy I'm back.
Two tweets equal one Facebook post.
That's
I don't know
question.
If that math adds up there, Adam.
I don't know either, but it will help me sleep at night. So again, thanks to everyone for putting up with our revised schedule here this summer and all the extra work that you guys have put in. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll share our top three movies of the year so far. Now, just a reminder, Adam, only Before Midnight, not Before Sunrise and Before Sunset is
what?
Eligible.
Come
Sorry.
On.
Sorry. Stay with us.
Turn it on. Turn it on. I'm ready to go. Where we're headed.
Come now to this segment affectionately known as Pay the Dealer. It's where we thank our very generous Film Spotting listeners who have donated some of their hard-earned cash our way in support of the show. And the biggest thing, Josh, I've felt regret about over this past month or so that I haven't been here to do a new show is the fact that we haven't been able to share these donations because listeners donated, they sent us some great notes, they probably were expecting them to be read in a timely manner, especially if, let's say, as we're going to get to at the end, there was a birthday message.
Oh no.
That's now.
We missed a birthday.
Probably just a little bit out of date.
Nice.
I do feel bad, but it is what it is, and let's just go ahead and get to the names. We start with two $10 a month donors.
That would be Parker from Austin, Texas, and also Lewis from Chicago.
Some new $5 a month donors, Holly in Castle Rock, Colorado, Nina in Florence, Massachusetts, and we have Monique. I don't know if it's the actress Monique, if she's listening to the show, the comedian turned actress.
I think that's a fair assumption.
It's just Monique, though. I couldn't get a location, couldn't get anything, so thank you, Monique. We also heard from Kelly Wesson.
After nearly 5 years of listening and wanting to donate, I have finally become a $5 a month donor. Film Spotting has been there for all of my road trips since I began listening. Originally, my friend Samantha and I would listen to the podcast on our trips to Cincinnati to see all the films being reviewed that weren't available where we lived, Charleston, West Virginia. Then last semester, I had to move 3 hours from my graduate school and make trips to Cleveland once a week to meet with my advisor. Film Spotting kept me entertained and on my critic toes with some of the best conversation for which I could ask. Now, master's degree in hand, you guys keep me company each week on 4-hour road trips to visit my long-distance boyfriend. You've been the best friends I could ask for in an empty car for thousands of miles back and forth, and I could not be more grateful. You keep me awake and ahead of the game in every genre of film and expose me to some films I'd have never heard of otherwise.
Yay us. Thank you, Callie, for that great message. We're glad you are enjoying the show. Some new Silver Club donors. Mike, one's a party, one's a crowd, Weston. And that's, of course, a patented Sam Van Halgren nickname. He is, as he notes here, Josh, an annual Silver Club donor since 2006.
Wow.
And he donated to us very decisively, very deliberately here, $78. It's the new buck a show, he calls it. It's $1 for every week of the year for Film Spotting, $52 plus $26 for Film Spotting SVU. So now I have to cut them a check.
Yeah, that math does check out.
Oh, it's terrible.
Robert Lewis in Damascus, Maryland is also a silver donor, as well as Matthew in Studio City, California, and Dalton from Fenton, Iowa.
Love it. I'm not familiar with Fenton, even though I spent most of my life in Iowa. That's what I love about being from Iowa is there are 100 towns I've never heard
of. Lovely little pockets, huh?
Yeah, lovely little pockets. I'm sure they all have a pizza ranch just for you, Josh. Dalton says, I've been listening to your show for a few months, and now that I've graduated from college and I'm on my way to a career in public accounting, I figured it was time to fill out a 1099 and send some money your way. I'd also like to take the opportunity to shamelessly share my eulogy for Roger Ebert, who would have turned 71 this week. I think this is a donation from a few weeks ago now. Though the loss of his critical mind and worldview are irreplaceable, I'm happy to have discovered two new voices of insight in the field of film criticism. Thanks for the continually engaging an entertaining show, and keep up the good work. And here's that link. I did check it out today. It is very well-written stuff from Dalton. So if you are curious about what he had to say, we'll link to that Tumblr over on our webpage, filmspotting.net. That brings us to our final round of new donors. We start with
Roger from Austin, Texas. Also have Matt N. from here in Chicago, Ben from Toronto, and Jeffrey from Neshanic Station, New Jersey. Andrea also donated from San Antonio, Texas, and Leslie from West Sacramento, California.
She says, ah, summer, beach and movies and barbecue. I'm sending you the film Deuterino's $20 to cover the cost of those steaks you keep talking about.
Nice.
Well played. Well played.
Rebecca from Pittsburgh said, I knew it was finally time to pay the dealer when I found myself using the word steaks multiple times while discussing the new Star Trek movie. Thanks for all you guys do every week and for giving me the ability to act like I know what I'm talking about when it comes to movies. You're awesome.
I think that is our basic function. We're here. Hopefully you can just lift something halfway insightful.
Steal material.
Please do. And finally, my sincere regrets and apologies to Agnes and to Matt. Agnes is here in Chicago. You know what? We owe them at least a drink or something. Let's invite Agnes and Matt. They're here in Chicago. They can come to our next taping. We'll buy them a drink at the Billy
Club. Why not? Matt's probably like 33 and a half by now.
Exactly.
Anyway, so.
But Agnes wanted to wish you, Matt, a happy 33rd birthday, now a belated 33rd birthday. I wonder if she finally broke down and said, you know, those jerks at Film Spotting.
She got them something else.
Yeah, and they just haven't followed through, or if she just waited patiently. Either way, congratulations on yet another birthday, Matt, and I'm serious. We'll make it up to you here at some point, buy you a drink maybe before a Film Spotting taping. Happy 33rd birthday, and thanks again to all of our very generous donors. A quick plug about our music this week. Our featured artist is Michael Cronin. This is from his new album, MC2. It's been named by many as among the best of the year, which seemed appropriate with our topic this week. And he will be playing Pitchfork, that music festival here in Chicago, on the 19th. Very popular, obviously, here in the city. And if you like what you heard, you can seek him out there.
Hi, this is Andrew Stanton. I'm the director of films like Finding Nemo and WALL-E, and now John Carter, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
You're good, man. I'll give you that. You got it all worked out, huh?
Perhaps that's why the people keep electing me, Billy. Because I simply get the job done.
So all this, it was all for the city?
Everything I do is for this great city. I chose you because I own you.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. It's early to mid-July. It's that point of the year when we take stock of the year in cinema and share our top five best films of the year so far. And some more misdirection there with that clip. That's a clip featuring Mark Wahlberg and Russell Crowe from a little gem, not so much, from earlier this year called Broken City.
Oh, I forgot that movie existed.
Yes, I'd like to forget it existed. As we get to picks three through one of our favorite films of the year so far, we thought we'd take a moment to be a little bit negative and share our picks for the worst films of the year so far. And usually this doesn't happen because it is true that we tend to only see movies that we really are excited to see. So it is the case more often than not that we're disappointed by films, but we don't just openly hate and deride movies. But occasionally we see films like Broken City, and that happens. The first film in a very long time, Josh, I gave it over an hour, and I actually decided I couldn't take it anymore. It's this corrupt detective, New York City mayor, murder movie, and there's nothing worse than watching Mark Wahlberg play Ernest. And the movie not only tries to be this corrupt political story, but also have a profound message and make you feel something, too, and I just finally couldn't take it anymore. I gave it more than half of the film. I finally just got up and left.
You were out of there.
I was.
That's a rarity.
That's my least favorite film of the year. I have two other picks. What about you?
My least favorite? It's got to be The Lone Ranger. And this thing is...
Haven't seen it yet.
Oh, it's almost worth seeing because of how bizarrely bad it is in terms of the tonal dissonance. I mean, you do have Johnny Depp obviously doing his kind of Willy Wonka, Jack Sparrow routine as Tonto, which has a whole range of problems, which are huge problems that we should pause and acknowledge that Tonto is a very racist character. And just because Johnny Depp is playing him doesn't really solve that issue. That's just one thing with this movie, though. It does try to acknowledge historical aspects of the U.S.'s relationship with Native Americans and the awful horrors. So there are scenes of genocide here. There are scenes of Comanche warriors being mowed down by U.S. Army soldiers with Gatling guns. And then literally 8 seconds later will be Johnny Depp like doing a little joke. And how the filmmakers decided they could put these two things together. Never mind that this is a movie that's going to be billed toward families because of the Pirates of the Caribbean connection with director Gore Verbinski. I mean, there's a scene of the villain literally eating someone's heart out in this Disney Lone Ranger Tonto comedy. I mean, I don't
subversive.
Know.
You're not giving
is
it
that the
credit.
Word for it?
Yeah.
Is that, I'm waiting for that review to come along, the positive subversive review.
Actually, it's already out there. And I only know this, Josh, because one of my favorite critics, I saw this on Critic Wire. There are a few people responding to the backlash from hardened critics like you who can't see the genius of this film. Matt Zoller Seitz, really smart guy, really good critic. He goes to bat for this film, and he says it's doing some of those things that actually make it more than what you're giving it credit for.
I'll have to check that out, but I that would involve a lot of stretching for me. And
really?
You know, I like to go in that direction when
you
I
do.
Can. Couldn't do it this time.
Once I was a soldier, I fought on foreign sands for you. Once I was a hunter, and I brought home fresh meat for you.
Well, my other two picks for worst film of the year, though these are behind Broken City, they're not as bad as Broken City. Next one from the bottom is a little film called Greetings from Tim Buckley. It's a movie I watched on demand. It's based on a true story, if you will, or at least based on real characters, the musician Tim Buckley and his son Jeff Buckley. I'm a big Jeff Buckley fan. He's played by Penn Badgley, who people will know from Margin Call in a small role, but probably more significantly, I believe, from Gossip Girl. He was one of the stars of that show. And he was maybe born to play Jeff Buckley because he can sing like him, which few people can. And he looks a lot like him as well. And the movie tries to mix these two stories together. We see flashbacks of Tim Buckley when he's Jeff's age and about to have Jeff. And then Jeff has been invited to do a tribute show to his father, who has since passed 20 years ago or so. They never really got to know each other. And talk about, I hate this word because it gets thrown around with films like Upstream Color that I don't think it applies to, pretentious. But this is what a pretentious movie is. It's one that really is completely empty and doesn't have anything significant to say, but seems to think it's saying something really profound. The that there's really something heavy going on. And there just isn't. There are some scenes in the film that were among the most painful scenes I've seen this year, second only to Broken City. So that's down there at number two from the bottom. And then my other one, I'm sorry, it's the one we still split on, Oz the Great and Powerful. Third worst film I've seen this year.
Wow.
Yeah. I felt bludgeoned by that movie, just bludgeoned into submission by it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it wasn't like among my favorites, not in my top 20, but I'm not going to go that hard in defense of it. I can't see it really being that bad that it'd be on the bottom, though. You haven't seen Despicable Me 2 then yet.
I haven't, though my kids are dying to see it.
Oh, they'll love it.
So
they'll
do it this weekend.
I'm in the minority of my family. I was on the first one, too.
You're a Grinch.
I don't get the Minions. And so
if
you don't get the Minions, you're going to have a tough time with this.
You don't get Harpo Marx. You don't get the Minions. You don't understand comedy.
There might be something there. There's a little connection, I think. Actually, I think it's more Three Stooges is the connection to the Minions. And, you know, there's like hundreds of Minions. So it's like having the Three Stooges just multiplied. Pretty painful for me.
I don't think you can call them Minions if there's only three or four.
So. That's true. Just too many. And the movie has a weird obsession with matchmaking, too. It takes this Gru character voiced by Steve Carell, and there are multiple characters obsessed with finding him a wife.
Yeah.
Because he's now in the sequel, you know, the adoptive father of these three girls.
Right.
And so that's kind of the main plot. All sorts of weird things going on in it. I'm sorry if you have to go see it with
so
kids.
Lone Ranger, Despicable Me, two big tentpole kind of summer movies.
The other one would be Man of Steel, which, you know, Michael and I took care of on the last show.
And
not
I
much
still,
more to say about
still
that.
Still had a chance to see Man of Steel. Unfortunately, it is on my list. We'll see if I can get there right after Despicable Me 2. Let's end all the negativity and bitterness, and let's get back to our countdown of the best films of the year so far. We shared our number 5 and 4 picks earlier in the show. Let's recap that briefly here, Josh. Your picks were
Like Someone in Love from Abbas Kiarostami and Terrence Malick's To the Wonder.
My number 5 was Après-Mai, the latest film from writer-director Olivier Assayas, and my number 4 was Mud, starring Matthew McConaughey, from writer-director Jeff Nichols. We are at number 3. What's your pick?
All right, this positivity feels a lot better. Mm-hmm. I like this. My number 3 is Beyond the Hills. I have to say, of all the movies on my list, this is the one I'd most like to revisit. I think the one on your list I'd like to revisit is Mud, but Beyond the Hills, I want to get a better grip on this mixture it has of so many things. There's horror, religion, social commentary, a little bit of neorealism at play here as well. This is set in a Romanian monastery, and the main storyline involves this new young nun who's trying to convince her childhood friend to join this religious life she's leading now, but this has disastrous results.
Aline, eu am vorbit cu părintele și eu dacă mă duc de aici înapoi nu mă mai primește.
Cum?
Așa au zis.
Păi și ce?
Cum păi și ce, Aline?
Păi, chiță, n-am zis noi gata de acum rămânem împreună orice ar fi, la ce să te întorci?
Am zis, Aline, dar nu ca să mergem pe vapor.
Păi și unde să mergem?
Do you remember in our Before Midnight review, we talked a little bit about how Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy were really working together to give a performance of one shared relationship?
Mm-hmm.
I think something similar is going on here with the two leads. That's Cosmina Stratton and Christina Flutur as these main characters. They really have some remarkable scenes together that build, again, a portrait of a relationship that's crucial. This push and pull between them is crucial to the narrative. The review I found of this that I really liked is A.O. Scott's in the New York Times. This was his great lead. He says, Christian Munju's Beyond the Hills is a tough and engrossing work of realism set in rural Romania in the dead of winter, but it also has some of the shadowy magic of an ancient folktale. At its heart are two orphan girls, one dark, one fair, whose destinies are intertwined even as their paths in life have diverged. One of them has fallen under a malign and powerful spell, or maybe both of them have. And he does capture this mixture of horror and reality that the movie is going after. And I'd like to revisit it because I'd like to figure out just, you know, which one of those is when he talks about which one of these women is under a spell. What mm-hmm. sort of spell might it be? It's a very, very mysterious movie.
Yeah.
Also one not available on DVD right now or streaming.
Yeah, from director, as you said, Christian Munju did the great 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. I was a big fan of this film as well. We reviewed that very favorably here on the show, and it's an honorable mention for me. So great pick. My number 3 is a movie I probably don't have to spend a lot of time dissecting how this experimental documentary, which I guess is the best way we can categorize it, relates to all the stuff I was talking about, the artistic process and drawing attention to itself as a movie, as a lot of my picks do. It's Stories We Tell from director Sarah Polley. This is a movie that combines Super 8 footage, real Super 8 footage, artificial Super 8 footage, reenactments, voiceover narration, A whole host of Brechtian devices are employed here to make sure you are always aware that you are watching a movie. More specifically, watching a movie being made, that you are watching that process unfold. And Sarah Pauley in the film describes this process as an interrogation of her family and those outside her family who are part of this family secret about her mother's possible extramarital affair and the identity of her biological father.
I remember Johnny saying that someone thought that your father might be someone that Mom had acted with in a play.
And I told them not to say anything to anyone, but then they turned it into a joke. And I did not participate in the joke, did I? I don't think I ever did.
I remember we talked about how you didn't look like Dad, and Dad joked about it.
I always thought, she does look like me. Got that little straight nose. Yeah, definitely. This is all nonsense, but it's fun. Who do you think your father is this week, Sarah?
We learn the truth as viewers about what really happened. Did she have the affair? Who her father really is? But the participants in the film, they all know the truth as they're being interviewed. So it's not about their discovery. It's not even really about our discovery on some level. It is about this idea of narratives and the stories that these family members construct as individuals, as a family unit, to understand who they are. And it's fascinating watching this film and seeing how the details shift and how stories change depending on who's telling it and how the perspectives shift. The question we talked about during our review that comes up early from one of the sisters is, who cares about our stupid family? I mean, it's kind of like, why are we doing this? Why are you even talking to me? Are people going to care about this? I cared. I think the mysteries, the characters themselves in terms of just being likable and interesting, the universal nature of their concerns, it's all there. And with Sarah Pauley now, I go back to Jeff Nichols, a guy with Shotgun Stories, Take Shelter, and his latest film, Mud. They're not as different stylistically as Sarah Pauley's three films are, but they are quite different, though dealing with a lot of the same thematic concerns and issues. And Sarah Pauley here with Away From Her and Take This Waltz, and now this movie, Stories We Tell, they really are very divergent in how they use cinema, but they definitely are dealing with similar questions. Marriage comes up a lot, and family identity. But again, that idea of the stories these people tell themselves is really explored in her work, and maybe that's why I respond so favorably to it. Even though I didn't love Take This Waltz, there was still enough going on there that it made me really appreciate it. And I think Sarah Pauley is definitely a force that we're going to be reckoning with for a long time, which is great.
Boy, I thought this was going to be higher on your list, actually, but great choice wherever it is. It was definitely an honorable mention for me. A really fascinating documentary.
Available on DVD September 3rd is the date I saw.
Are you currently using steroids?
No, ma'am.
When's the last time you injected?
Monday.
Yesterday. Okay.
I threw them all out. I think they messed me up.
It's okay. You probably just have defeated fella syndrome. We like treat it here all the time. But don't worry, we can change all that. That's what we specialize in here. Penis magic.
All right, number two for me, Pain and Gain. And I'm still shocked, actually, how much I enjoyed this movie, given my abhorrence for all things Michael Bay. But this is really one of those films that becomes, I think, in the collaborative process that we don't always give enough credit to, I think, in film criticism, in our eagerness to attribute the director with everything good or bad about a movie.
I don't know what you're talking about.
This is one of those examples where the collaborative process produces something more than that singular maker. This movie really is its own beast. It's this wild, raucous thing that maybe you can credit Bay with a little bit. I don't know. That's part of the mystery to this movie. It's based on this true story of a bunch of misguided bodybuilders. They try to shortcut their way to the American dream via this ill-advised extortion and kidnapping plan. Now, somehow, the movie manages to both lampoon the Bay style and use it. It uses it perfectly to make this fairly incisive statement about how the American dream, especially I think in the 2000s, it became something that we all really felt we deserved in a way, and it wasn't something that we needed to work towards or we needed to earn. We were Americans. We deserve our dream. That's how the guys in this movie are. And I'm not crazy here in seeing this work a little bit in Pain and Gain. Dana Stevens of Slate, she had a conflicted review about it, but she did at least recognize this thread. Here's what she wrote. Like Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers, to which it's being widely compared, Pain and Gain is a critique of American consumerism and mindless violence that unashamedly revels in its own nihilism and tawdriness and incoherence, its triumphant meta-stupidity. Of the two, I would rather pick neither, but if forced at gunpoint, hopefully not by bikini-clad chicks in pink ski masks, I'd have to go with Pain and Gain, if only for that strangely sweet moment when Dwayne Johnson, hiding out in an abandoned sex toys warehouse, inspects a rubber prosthetic vagina with an expression of boyish wonder. I guess Pain and Gain, Adam, maybe that's just more my brand of lurid prankishness than Spring Breakers.
Well, you had me at vagina, so now I can't wait to see it.
I'm actually waiting for you to see this one.
So Pain and Gain is that movie that I'm just so overjoyed that it's this high on your list, because now I can just add it to the list of 12 Angry Men. I can add it to The Wrath of Khan, Rocky VI, all the movies you're wrong about. More ammunition for our listeners to use against you in future disagreements.
Have you seen it?
No, see, that's the joke. I have not seen Pain and Gain. I've been wanting to seek it out, obviously, because I knew how much you liked it. And
it's in that limbo right now, I think, though, right? Between being in theaters and
I think August sometime.
Yeah, August 27 is the DVD release.
It's finally going to come out. I just kept missing it in theaters. It got down to like one screen in Chicago, and I just couldn't make it. But I knew it was going to come up in your top five, so I really did want to see it before then, just so I could hopefully take you to task here for it and call you out for loving a Michael Bay film.
I think it's going to resonate with you. I really do.
Well, I am a sucker for The American Dream, as you know. My number two film, not a surprise here, is a movie that we spent close to 40 minutes discussing on our last show together, I believe, actually, about a month ago, and that is Before Midnight. So I'm not going to babble on about the Richard Linklater film here. If you want to hear me babble on about it for 40 minutes with Josh's help, you can find that show. It's Film Spotting, episode 449. Just do a search in iTunes or go to our website. I'm going to enlist some help from our listeners here. We got a great voicemail from David, all of 18 years old, but much wiser than his years.
Gentlemen, David from Pennsylvania here, hoping I can shine some light on that behemoth 40-minute conversation on Linklater's Before Midnight, which sort of evolved into more of a study of the entire trilogy's place in different age brackets. So in response to Adam's question concerning the accessibility of the first movie to 20-somethings, I can say as an 18-year-old, it sits firmly in my top 10 of all time. Ethan Hawke's, quote, sweet goatee was the only thing that seemed a little antiquated and dweeby, but the rest of the film resonated as deeply as I'm sure it did the first time you guys saw it. The awkwardness, the tension, the wild, passionate feelings mistaken for love. Fundamentally, I think this movie is never going to age, really, because the stupidity and earnestness and bliss of young romance is captured more honestly here than I've ever seen in a movie. Then again, I haven't seen Casademia Padre, so I don't know. Heard it's a masterpiece. Anyways, so you guys are the best, and thank you for every week inspiring me to be more pretentious than my 18-year-old friends. Keep it up. Bye.
Thank you, David, for that very eloquent, articulate voicemail, the little jab at Casa de Mi Padre. I appreciate it. I'm glad we can help you become more pretentious.
If he continues to like films like Casa de Mi Padre, that'll help him with that not being pretentious thing.
Yeah, that is true. Maybe he's got that to look forward to. But I think David did say that really well, and he's answering a question that I threw out during our discussion about whether or not these films really would resonate with younger audiences, or how much they would resonate with people who, unlike us, are about the same age as Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy's characters are. And we've really grown up with these films and gotten to experience them kind of in real time, so to speak. I was very curious how other generations would respond to these movies. You heard it from David, and actually the feedback in general was pretty overwhelming, not surprisingly to me, saying it's universal what these movies deal with, and we can recognize those themes. Doesn't really matter what age you are. If you're 18, you can go back and watch Before Sunrise and see elements in that you can relate to. It doesn't matter that it's 2013 or 1995. So thank you, David, for that. And I'll also mention this feedback from Alex, longtime listener. He's even got a Film Spotting nickname from Glengarry Glen Ross. It's Alex Mitchin Murray. He says, I wanted to help answer Adam's question from your Before Midnight discussion about how the Before trilogy affected me. Since I'm 27 and single, and I saw the first two when I was 21, friends I talked to about the movie Before Midnight think it's dark and depressing, but I appreciated how honest it seemed to be about the joys and struggles of marriage and parenthood, and I feel like the movie can serve as a guide for how I would think about those types of situations in my own future, just like Before Sunset does. I totally agree with both of you that these movies are a gift. Here's hoping Hawke, Delpy, and Linklater reunite in another 9 years, which is something we discussed. I felt a little bit different than you, which is I could see the trilogy ending, and I might actually be happier with that, as much as I love them, but I think I'm ultimately with you and with Alex that I do want to see what happens in those 9 years, because as we talk about my meta theme for this segment, for these films, we talked about Hawke and Delpy as writers and actors in this movie and this experiment that's going on of 9 years between these movies and how they're bringing their own experiences and perspectives to the film. And the whole thing, how it does feel like it's a flowing, organic entity. It feels like it's one thing. You joked about how they're not one film, they're three different films, but they really feel like they are of a whole. They are one unit. And the fact is, there will always be an interesting story to tell, I think, as long as Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy and Richard Linklater continue to get older and have different perspectives and different experiences and choose to bring them to the screen. We'll see those interesting stories unfold. So Before Midnight, for me, a very tough pick for number two to not be my number one film of the year. No word yet on a release date for this film. Actually, though, it is still in some theaters.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's probably still around
here in Chicago if you haven't had a chance to seek it out yet.
All right, my number one, this is the more experimental than upstream color film I referenced earlier, and it's actually a documentary. It's also my only four-star review of 2013 so far. The immersive documentary Leviathan, which is set on a commercial fishing vessel off the coast of New England. So there are no interviews with any of the fishermen here. There are no conversations we overhear. We don't really get much explanatory text or even identified figures. It's just 87 minutes of being plunged into the water and the work of this trawler. To give you an idea, a representative scene is one in which the camera just rests on the deck floor while fish parts slosh back and forth for minutes on end. This isn't going to work for everyone, but for whatever reason, I found it completely entrancing. Partly this was just on a purely aesthetic level, just the visuals that these cameras happen to capture. I've never seen anything like a number of these shots, but one of them that stands out to me is the sight of the seagulls at night when they're floating in the distance alongside the ship. It takes a while to even figure out what they are, where they are, what they're doing, but their flaps of white, they kind of emerge like these persistent heartbeats in the darkness. And I just found myself able to watch that for as long as the camera held it. And I also think that there's something about this particular setting that does strike some existential chords. There's that moment where the camera is plopped into this tank. And again, things aren't explained. So they appear to be stunned fish that have recently been caught, and they're in this tank. They're floating back and forth, and it's like this state of glassy-eyed purgatory. It was really troubling to watch. Now, the directors are Verena Paravel and Lucien Kesting Taylor. They place these digital, mini digital camcorders all over the ship. And Callum Marsh of Slant Magazine, he had this to say about the technique. It becomes so that you can no longer even ask yourself how such and such shot or effect was achieved. Its impossibility is central to the disorienting effect, to the sense that you're seeing the world as nobody does, and there's magic in not knowing. And that's a similar thing came to mind. I called the film in my review, Welcome Disorientation. You don't always know where you are, but nevertheless, it is this entrancing experience. Mm-hmm. Now, this has been really hard to see because the filmmakers, I've been waiting for this since last year when I first heard about it. The filmmakers are rightly encouraging people to experience it on the big screen. So they're not sending out DVDs, and it hasn't been playing at a ton of theaters. Don't trust Can I Stream It on this one, because that's the site we use to find out where things might be streaming. They'll send you to an Amazon link to the 1989 Peter Weller underwater thriller.
Yeah.
That's not what you want.
Are you sure?
No. Haven't seen that Leviathan, but I'm guessing this one's better.
Callum Marsh, very smart critic, has a great take on Leviathan. You have a great take on Leviathan. It is one of those cases, though, you can point to. Talk about people having a very different experience in the same exact theater,
yes,
sitting right next to each other. It was the rare film that we saw together. Hasn't happened in a long time.
No.
And we saw that movie here in Chicago at the Gene Siskel Film Center, sitting right next to each other. We seemed to be both in that kind of dazed state watching this film, but you really did have a much more intense reaction to it than I did. And I really don't want to say anything more about it to denigrate it, because the fact is, I actually did write down my notes on the film because I thought we might discuss it, and we ran out of time on the show we thought we were going to talk about it on. So I have a lot of notes. I have a lot of thoughts on it. I'm hoping at some point we can actually get to it, and I can try to articulate more my mixed reaction to it.
Sure.
It was one of my most anticipated films of the year, and that was one where I felt like I was watching the experiment, could recognize and appreciate the experiment, didn't connect with me.
Mm-hmm.
So again, maybe whether it's bonus content or a future show, maybe we can talk about that a little bit further. My number one pick for film of the year so far is another film that we disagree on, and that is Steven Soderbergh's Side Effects. It stars Channing Tatum and Jude Law. More significantly, maybe, it stars Rooney Mara. She's kind of the main character in the film. She's married to Tatum's character. He goes away to prison for a few years for some white-collar crime, comes back, and, well, that's all I'm really going to say about it, because then there is a crime that happens that Rooney Mara's character commits, and she ends up going to see Jude Law's character along the way, who is a psychiatrist. And, yes, the movie from the title, as it suggests, it gets into the pharmaceutical world and what some of those side effects are to taking some of those drugs. But that really is just the basic, most basic setup for the film.
Dr. Rings, I really need to talk to you.
Emily. Yeah, I just got your message. I'm with my wife.
I went to your office, but you weren't there. So I came here and, can we just go talk?
If it's an emergency, I can admit you.
I just, I was getting on the subway and it was like when I was in the car. I have to go to work. I just need 5 minutes.
You're gonna get to work after. Okay, 5 minutes.
Okay.
Whenever this movie comes up, Josh, you like to evoke the Danny Boyle film Trance. You basically say it covers similar ground, but you think Trance actually does it better. So I'm going to beat you to the punch on this one, because I think it will help me articulate why I think Side Effects is not only a much better film than Trance, but why it's actually a great film. One of the two films offers a lot of human frailty and ugly truths about who we are and uses them as fodder to produce really cool visuals and plot twists. That's Trance. The other film, Side Effects, offers cool visuals and plot twists and uses them as fodder to explore human frailty and ugly truths about who we are. In other words, one is mostly entertaining, but also mostly mindless and an unprovocative exercise in style. The other actually has something on its mind and uses style and noir conventions to express what's on its mind. You, like many people, in fairness, get bogged down in the second half of the film. We talked about that during the review. There's a shift in focus in terms of who the main character is. The plotting gets much more convoluted, doesn't really seem to be in keeping with maybe the first half of the film. In my mind, though, that criticism is truly missing the entire point of the film. And unfortunately, I can't spoil it here. But for me, the movie's weight comes from that shift. It comes from the behavior and the maneuvering of the character we initially identified with and sympathized with, and how that changes, and how our sympathy and identification with that character changes. You can't have it any other way. You simply couldn't have the first half of the film without the second half of the film, as I read the movie. And back when we talked about it, I described it as Rosemary's Baby meets House of Games, and I'm standing by that. And we talked about how Soderbergh uses focus in really interesting ways, a lot of distorted views, a lot of close-ups, so you don't see a lot of backgrounds. It's really just whatever the one character is looking at and the way they're perceiving the world. And that gets back, of course, to that idea of narratives and constructing stories and seeing the truth as only you basically want to see it. And we have characters in this film who can only see what not only they want to believe, but sometimes they're willfully obscuring the truth to try to meet their needs, to make themselves happy. In search of that happiness, they'll do whatever it takes to get there. And that hit me. Beyond just the plotting, and obviously from a visual standpoint, Soderbergh is Soderbergh. There's always something interesting going on. I didn't expect Side Effects to actually have something profound to say. And I think it does. And that's why, for me, it's the number one film of the year.
Now, did you like it that much right away, or has it risen in your estimation?
No,
since,
no. Okay, it's pretty much been number one since I saw it.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And it hasn't been toppled yet.
Yeah, I mean, the Trance comparisons, they are interesting. I guess for me, it's the noir conventions aspect of that, where it feels like a gimmick in Side Effects to me in that second half, embracing those and going nuts for those, whereas there's a consistency in Trance to mm-hmm. me. I do think I was looking back to form this list and how high might Trance rank, and because I gave it, I think, 3.5 out of 4 stars. I probably overrated Trance a little bit, but I still feel pretty well about how I came down on Side Effects. It's just one of these Soderbergh experiments that gets more experimenty as it goes on, and that was just distancing to me. I mean, it may have accomplished what he was setting out to do and what he wanted to comment on, but I still feel that it undermined the good movie I enjoyed. The first half of Side Effects probably had a good chance of being on my top 5.
Wow, and for me, the first half was really good. Without the second half, that's where it completely launched into a different category for me. That's where it became a great film, was because of the second half and the way it reinforced and commented on added to the first, not because it went in a different direction.
It was the commentary, though. It was the, I don't want the commentary. Sometimes I want a story. And he was telling a very good story. Jude Law was giving one of his best performances in recent years. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, things start commenting on themselves. And I took a step back. I lost Jude Law's performance, became less engrossing because he was no longer this character. He was now a genre trope that Soderbergh was using to make comments.
He was a more complicated character. He was a more complicated, more difficult character to grasp, whereas the first half of the film,
he was less
he's
human.
Exactly who he is.
He was much less human. And the same goes for Rooney Mara's picture.
I disagree completely. I think he only gets more human, and that's the frightening part in the second half of the film.
There are elements,
that's the whole point.
There are elements in an experiment in that second half of the film. And maybe if the entire film had been that Soderberghian experiment, which we've gotten before in something like The Limey, and I had never been attached to them as real people, and I just took them on that level, I would have been happy with it, but to get half and half, to lose that humanity of the first half, really distanced me.
Hmm. Well, we obviously disagree on my number one film of the year, Side Effects. Those are our top five best movies of the year so far. What about honorable mentions? A couple of mine have already come up, but I guess essentially your 6 through 10. I don't know if you've ranked them or not, but what other films did you consider?
Well, the one that you mentioned that was on mine, Stories We Tell. Really appreciated that documentary. I do have Trant still on there, though, like I said, probably initially overrated it a little bit. I really enjoyed World War Z. Fan of zombie movies. There's not a lot here in terms of thematic depth or metaphor or allegory, which the best zombie movies have, but man, is it fun. A lot of fun. Star Trek Into Darkness. Best Star Trek film we've gotten yet. And also, I just saw I'm So Excited, the latest Pedro Almodovar film. Didn't squeak into my top five. Probably would make it somewhere in my top 10, still processing it. It was quite a bit of fun. And then I don't know if we can count this, but it's kind of falling into these in-between categories. And I know it did play in its entirety, I believe, at the Cannes Film Festival. Jane Campion's long movie / miniseries now available on Netflix, Top of the Lake. I just started
watching that?
A couple of those. Really, really interesting.
You like it?
I do. Can't wait to find out how it ends, and we'll probably burn through those in the next couple of days here.
Discussed a few months back on our sister
Film
show, Spotting
SVU.
I don't remember what they said about it. I may have shut it off because I hadn't been watching.
I'm in the middle right now, and I might wait till I finish the rest of the series to listen to the end.
So my honorable mentions, these are in alphabetical order here. Four of them have come up in one form or another already throughout this show. Two of the movies that were in your top five, Beyond the Hills and Like Someone in Love, the Kiarostami movie. Spring Breakers is in my top 10.
Yeah, I thought that'd be in the top five.
No, just outside it. It kept getting pushed back by a few other films that I caught up with. Upstream Color is there in my top 10, the Shane Carruth movie. And then rounding out the honorable mentions is a film Michael Phillips is a big fan of. I think it probably would have been in his top five had he been here on the show to share the pick. And it's a movie I just saw a few nights ago, really good, starring Gael Garcia Bernal. It's called No. It's a movie that is available via iTunes. I think you can watch it on demand as well. And it's the story of a marketing executive in Chile who gets hired to help oust Pinochet, the dictator, from power. It basically comes down to there's a yes or no vote. You want to keep him in power or no, as the title of the film suggests, you want change. And he gets tasked with trying to sell a new concept, a new era in Chilean life to the people. And it's a really, really fascinating film with a great performance by Bernal. And maybe it's another one we can talk about further at some point. So No is definitely in my top 10 of the year as it stands right now. I don't know, Josh, if there were any other categories or anything else that jumped out to you that you feel compelled to share as you looked over your list. But a couple of things that stood out to me. I recognize that there have been a lot of really good music documentaries so far this year, and I don't know if you've seen any of these films, but picking up right where Searching for Sugar Man left off last year, there's been Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me, a documentary about that seminal band that I knew nothing about, I have to admit, and lose all my street cred. Watched that documentary, really fascinated by that group. A Band Called Death, a documentary about a trio from Detroit, African-American guys who were basically playing American punk years before the Ramones did it, and they only finally got discovered way later, just recently, as of a few years ago.
Yeah, Michael talked favorably about that one last time he was on.
It is a good film. And Sound City, the documentary from Dave Grohl, who directs it, about that studio where Nirvana's Nevermind was recorded, a lot of other classic albums, Fleetwood Mac, a lot of great bands did their best work at that studio. And it's a love letter to that studio, to the mixing board, and just to great music. And I think on Letterboxd, I said that Dave Grohl was making a film basically that was self-indulgent in the greatest way. I didn't mean it as a knock. It's like he basically found an excuse to get to go out and talk to all of his favorite musicians and get them in a recording studio to record new tracks. And God bless him for it. It's really a fun movie.
Yeah, well,
that's
like a director interviewing other directors in a lot of ways and getting those insights that someone else might not be able to get.
I also thought about, as I looked at my list, there were two films that jumped out at me that were movies that I liked, without a doubt, and recommend without a doubt, but that I probably should have loved. In other words, I think they were probably underrated by me. And the first one is Francis Ha. If you listen back to our review, I don't think I said a single negative thing about it. It was overall a pretty glowing review. And yet, for some reason, when it actually came time to rank it in terms of the year's best, I just found it kind of in the middle of the pack. And I found that I was putting other films ahead of it. And I haven't completely figured out why, because
I think
it's an interesting film.
It is, but I think that's a reflection of a film's slightness. I think that's what distance gives us.
I didn't want to use that word, but that is how I feel.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it too for what it was and for what it did, and there were many good things about it. But I think that's what ranking, as much as we complain about ranking and say that it's a worthless exercise, I think it does help you to gauge a little bit of the weight that a movie has after some time.
Sure, and in fairness to the Francis Ha fanatics out there, and there are a few, we got this note from Anna Zemansky in Brooklyn who said, I thought you both underrated Francis Ha. Not only is it a pitch-perfect portrayal of late 20s life in hipster Brooklyn, but it's also the only comedy I can think of that features a woman and has nothing to do with her relationship status. I can't think of a single other film like that. And you can't discuss this film in relation to Woody Allen or New Wave cinema without noting how significant it is that a woman, Greta Gerwig, is doing most of the writing, along with Noah Baumbach.
Yeah, that's definitely one of its qualities. Where was that email from again?
Anna in Brooklyn.
Oh, that's right.
Maybe she could relate. I don't know. We don't want to cast aspersions on Anna's character, but that is a movie I want to revisit and see if it does resonate more as the year goes on. The other one is a movie called Simon Killer from Antonio Campos, who directed the really interesting movie After School, which we screened here with Antonio Campos at a film spotting event 4 years ago now, maybe. And this is his follow-up to that. It stars Brady Corbett, who you may not want to remember as one of the guys from Funny Games, but a good actor. Again, a movie I recommend, a movie I like, but a movie I feel like is doing enough interesting things with the camera that I should have had a much stronger reaction to it than I did. And maybe like Francis Ha, it's one that I just need to revisit. Finally, the best third of a movie I saw all year, The Place Beyond the Pines. Unfortunately, there's two more acts, but the first third of The Place Beyond the Pines.
Yeah, I still have to see that one.
Is one of my top five films of the year with Ryan Gosling and Bradley Cooper in that film from Derek C. in France, who also did Blue Valentine. So that is our epic best films of the year so far show. We want to know what you think. We want to get your picks or any other comments about the show. Email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release this weekend, opening here in Chicago, you can find Dealing with Idiots. This is Jeff Garland's film. He wrote, directs, and stars in it. The idiots in question are the parents of a competitive youth baseball team, a too competitive youth baseball team. Also, The Look of Love. This is the latest collaboration between Michael Winterbottom and Steve Coogan. That's a tandem I love. It's about the life of Paul Raymond, who was a controversial entrepreneur who became England's richest man. And finally, The Time Being. Wes Bentley stars as an artist who meets a wealthy benefactor played by Frank Langella, and their relationship, I guess it's something we could have fun speculating about. That's all we know right now about The Time Being. Out in wide release, Grown Ups 2.
Can I give you a little Grown Ups 2 story?
Yeah, please.
So we went July 5 to Six Flags Amusement Park, and while you're in the hour and a half line, the TVs they have there to entertain you, Grown Ups 2 trailer on a loop.
Oh, no.
Can I give it a bad review just based on that?
Yeah. Right. I think you can, actually.
There's a moose, and I believe all the leads are naked at one point. So if that entices you.
I have seen that trailer, unfortunately, and I can't unsee it. Also out, Pacific Rim. It says right here, Josh, robots versus sea monsters.
Spoiler.
Sea monsters. It's directed and co-written, of course, by Guillermo del Toro. Idris Elba, Charlie Hunnam, and Rinko Kikuchi star in it. That's all I needed to know, though. Robots versus sea monsters with Elba, Hunnam, and Kikuchi.
You've been waiting for that trio.
It is. It's the movie I've been longing to see. So that's out this weekend. And on our next show, we do plan to discuss Pacific Rim and share our top five movie robots. But in the interim, our friends from Film Spotting SVU, Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore, will be here. They're going to take over the mothership for
Very
a week,
nice.
Which is great. And they always do fine, fine work, so look forward to that.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Melatia at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week was by Michael Cronin. You can learn more at michaelcronin.bandcamp.com, and that's Michael, M-I-K-A-L. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.